In our upcoming Parsha, Parshas Lech Lecha, we read about Avraham's initial conversation with God. Vayomer Hashem el Avraham, Lech Lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetcha mi'beis avicha u'ha'aretz asher areka. Interestingly enough, very little is known about the early part of his life. Of course, Avraham was 70 or 75 at the time of this conversation, and there are more mekoros over here if anyone needs. But what happened in the early part of his life? So while the Torah Shebichtav does not elaborate, Chazal do in a number of places, and we're going to begin with the perspective of the Rambam, which is source number one. It's actually a little cut off at the beginning, and we'll begin where it says Halacha Gimel. The context of this Rambam is the history of idolatry. The Rambam describes how it is that idolatry could emerge in a world in which, at least initially, everybody believed in God. And the Rambam argues that the root of idolatry is the service of God through an intermediary. Nobody reasonable ever really thought that a particular statue made from stone was actually a god or the creator of the world or in some way powerful. But rather, at least initially, idolatry emerged due to the difficulty of serving an incorporeal god, someone you can't see, you can't feel, you can't touch, you can't hear. And to make things more tangible, people began serving the things that they could perceive, those magnificent creations of the God, the celestial bodies, and the like. And eventually, due to the passage of time, people forgot that they were serving intermediaries and began serving the idolatry, the idols, and the like, not as intermediaries. And it's in this context that we are introduced to Avraham Avinu. So this is where it says Halacha Gimel in source number one. Kevan shenigmal etan zeh, hischil l'shotet b'da'ato. V'hu katan v'ischil l'chshov b'yom u'v'alayla, v'haya tamea. Heach efshar shiyeh galgal hazeh noheg tamid, v'lo yelo manhig v'lo yisavev oso. Avraham Avinu, when he was still young, began asking the ultimate questions. Questions like, why is anything here? What accounts for it? How is it that there's an earth if there wasn't a creator? The particular formulation here that Rambam uses reflects his Aristotelian conception of the universe, and therefore he refers to spinning spheres. But the basic argument, the argument from design, a teleological argument for the existence of God, is one that could be formulated even today. Even today we could and we should ask questions like, why does anything exist? What started it all? If we accept the Big Bang theory, well, what triggered the Big Bang? There was something that must have started it if there's a beginning. Of course, we could theorize maybe there's a multiverse or something else outside of it, but still, what accounts for anything existing at all? And it's these types of questions that led Avraham Avinu to his belief in God. We'll continue reading in the Rambam. Other Rishonim, before the Rambam, formulated similar ideas. Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Pakuda, for example, gives the analogy, if you had a poem, you wouldn't just account for the poem by assuming that ink spilled haphazardly, but there must have been a poet. The truth is that this argument that the Rambam here writes very briefly is one of his four arguments that he gives in Mor Nevuchim, four proofs for the existence of God. And let's continue in the Rambam. So Avraham Avinu asked, what accounts for this spinning? Ki efshar sheyisavev es atzmo, it can't spin itself, there must be some outside force. V'lo hayalo melamed, v'lo modia davar, he had no teacher, no one taught him. Ela mushka b'orkazdim bein ovde kochavim hatipshim. V'aviv v'imo v'chol ha'am ovde kochavim. V'hu ovedi mahem. Avraham Avinu was stuck in orkazdim, in a world in which everyone was an idolater, including his family, And he served with them. This is a fascinating point. Hu haya oved imahem. You know, we say at the Seder, Metchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu. Initially, our avoseinu, our forefathers, were idolaters. So who is that? Who are avoseinu in that sentence? So some of the Mefarshim on the Haggadah, some of the Rishonim say it's referring to Terach and the like, Avraham's fathers. Other commentaries on the Haggadah say that it's referring to Avram Avinu. As we see over here, Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. Avram Avinu himself, he went with his parents to church every Sunday morning. So the Rambam understands that initially Avram began to question. He began to ask. He began to wonder. He began to observe that this whole system of idolatry doesn't make so much sense, but he didn't initially change his mind and immediately adopt monotheism. It was a path. It was a progression. It was something that happened over time. With this, the Rambam actually is trying to resolve, it would seem, two different Mamari Chazal. In one, Chazal depict Avram Avinu as coming to an appreciation of God at a very young age, and in others, when he was 40, when he was more developed. The Rambam understands this as a progression. When he was very young, he began asking these ultimate questions, as children often do. Sadly, sometimes, because they're not taken seriously, they stop asking these types of basic questions. And then, as he grew up, though he continued to serve idolatry, he began to become more and more firm in his conviction. As it says, V'libo mishotet umevin ad sheisig derech ha'emes. So he began to be troubled, and he wondered until eventually he came to the truth. And he came to know that there was one God, and he is the one that causes the sphere to rotate. He's not just a God that exists, but there's a God that continues to allow for the world's existence. Moreover, he created everything. And there is no other ultimate power besides him. And thus he became aware that the whole world was erring. What caused them to err was the fact that they served these intermediaries like the sun, the moon, and the stars until they forgot the truth. In other words, initially, when they were serving the sun, they might have understood that the sun was a creation of God and just a manifestation, but eventually they forgot that as well. Uven arba'im shana hikir Avraham es boro. And when he was 40 years old, he became fully aware of his Creator. Meaning to say, when he was a child, he began asking questions, and by the time he was 40, he came to the firm, absolute conviction that there is a single God. And thus, after he came to that firm conviction, he began to debate. He began to convince. He began to tell the world all about the truth. He told them that you're not following the correct path by serving idolatry. Vishiver Hatzlamim famously broke the idols. Vishil Hodiya La'am. There's no God that one should serve other than the single one God. And the Rambam continues, this gets him in trouble. The monarch was not particularly happy about his preaching. Rambam alludes to the correlation between politics and religion and how politicians use or monarchs use religion to serve their purposes. Avraham undermined that. Avraham Avinu then is the king, tries to kill him, and so on and so forth. We're all familiar with the story. The truth is the Rambam's idea over here that Avraham Avinu came to an awareness of God through the question of what could account for all of existence is not the Rambam's invention. The Rambam gets this from other sources. Source number two, it's a Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah. Amr Reb Yitzchak, Mashal le'echad shahaya over mimakom lemakom. Imagine the following analogy, a person who is going from place to place. It's interesting, why does it say this person is going from place to place? this perhaps I once heard from Rabbi Lapiansky, my teacher, that it's a reference to Avram's journey, what we referred to earlier. It's not like Avram Avinu discovered everything all at once, but he himself traveled in a journey. He himself made progress. It wasn't instantaneous, like we said before. He too wasn't initially a idolater. V'ra'ab bira'achas dolakas. And he sees a palace that's dolakas. Dolakas could be either lit on fire, engulfed in flames, or I think more likely it means illuminated, meaning to say he sees an illuminated palace. And he says, well, if there's a palace, there must be a builder. I think it's very precise. It doesn't just say over here that he saw a palace, and if there's a palace, there might have been a builder, but he sees an illuminated palace. Because the Medrash, like Rambam, as we noted before, is trying to prove not only is there a creator, but there's a God that is a manhig. It refers to God not just as a bore, but a manhig, someone who's continuously involved. And thus, the mashal is a illuminated palace, not just this palace that was perhaps one time built, but then left alone. So this person is traveling, he sees this illuminated palace. Amar, Tomar, Shabira, Zu, below manig, is it possible that this palace has no manig, has no director? And therefore, and here the Medrash doesn't stop, it doesn't just say, okay, well he discovered that there must be a manig to the world, but Heitzitz Alav Baal Habir, at that point the director of the palace looks out to him and speaks to him. This is going to be very significant, as we'll see shortly. Amar lo, Anihu Baal Habira. I am the Baal Habira. In other words, the person who built the palace, the person who maintains the palace, looks out. And when the onlooker says, wow, there must be something behind this, then the one who is behind this speaks to him, engages him. Kach lefi shehaya Avram Avinu Omer, Tomar sheha olam hazeh b'lo manhig. Because Avram was saying, is it conceivable that this world has no manhig? Hates it, Salav HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God looks at him, b'amar lo, and says to him, Anihu Baal Ha'olam. I am the master of the world, I'm the creator, and I'm the manhig of this world. We see Rambam uses this argument, the cosmological argument, as one of the ways in which a person can prove the existence of God. As I mentioned, he elaborates on this point, as well as others, in his Mor Nevuchim. And this raises an interesting question, which is clearly these types of philosophical and scientific arguments are important in terms of initially establishing and proving the existence of a Borei Olam. The question is, are they valuable for someone who already believes? If someone already believes in God, for whatever reason, is it important that they continue to study and look for proof for his existence? Is that something that's helpful or not? Rambam's position is that it is. The Rambam understands that the mitzvah of emunah is not just faith as in blind faith, but it's yediyah. The Rambam always refers to emunah as yediyah, knowledge of God's existence, and evidence, philosophy, science, and the like play a very important role in emunah and yediyah for the Rambam, and it's not just something that perhaps initially brought Avraham Avinu to recognition of God's existence, but it's something that even believers must and should engage in to strengthen their belief and the like. We, however, today are not going to be focusing on the Rambam's position, but rather the position of the Kuzari, of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who adopts a different view concerning the nature of emunah. And that's going to be today's discussion, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's perspective on emunah. Perhaps before beginning, it's worthwhile to very briefly introduce this great thinker. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was born in 1075 in Toledo, in Spain. In his youth, he studied under the Rif, as well as he was a friend of the Ri Magash. The Ri Magash, Rabbi Yosef ibn Magash, was Rambam's rabbi, or the truth is really Rambam's father's rabbi, though he thought of him as a rabbi. And Later on, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi became a great poet. He removed to Granada to become closer to another great poet, Rav Moshe Ibn Ezra. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi studied medicine, which provided him both a livelihood and inspiration. He married and had one daughter who, according to legend, married Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, the Ibn Ezra that we're familiar with from his commentary on the Torah. Besides writing the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote poetry, including secular poems, love poems. He wrote numerous odes depicting his love and longing for Eretz Yisrael, where he eventually journeyed. The legend is, as quoted in Shalshalas HaKabbalah by Rabbi Gedalia Ibn Yahya, that when he eventually did make it to the Holy Land, he bent down to kiss the stones of Yerushalayim and proclaimed Tzion Halo Tishali, the opening line from the Kina that we read on Tisha B'Av, and at that point was trampled by an Arab horseman and died. So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's most famous work, though, is the Kuzari, or to the entire translation of the title is The Book of Argument and Proof in Defense of a Despised Faith. It was written in Arabic, Kitab al-Kuzari, and it's based upon a story that reached Spain in the 10th century. The story itself took place a couple of centuries earlier, where the Khazar king converted, as well as many of his citizens, to Judaism. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes this story and creates a book, which is a play, a dialogue, about the discussions that might have convinced the Khazar king to eventually convert to Judaism. So this is not the conversation that actually happened. We don't know what happened. The king of the Khazars has a dream, a recurring dream, in which he's told by God that your motivations are noble, but your actions are not. This causes the Khazar king to invite a philosopher, a Christian theologian, a Muslim theologian, to have a debate. He rejects the philosopher, and in terms of the Christian and Muslim scholars, he notices very early on that their religions are based upon and built upon the Jewish faith. He didn't initially imagine inviting a Jew. After all, it's the despised faith. But after discovering that other faiths are built on top of it, he invites the Jewish scholar, known as the Chaver, rabbi, Jewish scholar, and eventually, he is convinced. In the second book, he converts to Judaism, and the conversation continues for five books until the Chaver announces his intended departure to the land of Israel. Now, we saw just a moment ago the Medrash that depicts Avram Avinu's questioning the basis for God's existence. And according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, this is not the end of faith. It does not end here with the person discovering God based off of a philosophical argument. Instead, as the Medrash notes, and we'll return to this later, Avraham's initial conversation with the Almighty develops into a relationship. And this brings us to the position of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in terms of Emunah. We'll refer to him as Rihal. And that is that a person who believes in God only based off of a philosophical argument is left with an undeveloped relationship, something that is far short of what the Torah expects us to have with respect to God. The Torah expects a relationship with God. Avas Hashem, Yira Shemaim. It's an intimate and personal relationship. He's our Yedid Nefesh. He's our Av HaRachaman. And that is something that does not emerge from a philosophical argument, even if the argument proves the existence of God. The way Rabbi Yehuda Halevi puts it is that we have to compare the difference between the God of Aristotle and the God of Avraham Avinu. The God of Aristotle did believe in God of some sort, and the God of Aristotle is a God, someone believes in this God, but it's a God that only exists based off of the philosophical evidence that can be conjured in favor of his existence. In other words, to go back to the argument that the Rambam has, so that would prove that there is some type of creator. It would prove that this creator continues to have a hand in the maintenance of the world, but it doesn't tell you much beyond that. It doesn't tell you anything about God's relating to people. It doesn't tell us about our responsibilities towards God. It doesn't imply anything in terms of our responsibilities towards God. It doesn't necessarily imply that we can relate to God. And thus, the Medrash continues, that after Avram Avinu discovers God, God speaks to him, and a relationship forms. And that's the God of Avraham. The God of Avraham is very different than the God of Aristotle. The God of Avraham is God with whom we have a relationship with, as we see in the stories of Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and later in the Torah. So what we'll do is look at some of the differences, some of the manifestations of Avram's great innovation. Avram's innovation, again, is not just that there isn't a God that exists, but there's a God with whom we could have a relationship. And we'll begin by noting a couple of differences. First of all, with respect to sacrifice. A person who believes in God only due to philosophical proof, someone who, as it were, believes in the God of Aristotle, will rarely give his life for that which he knows to be true. Let's give an example. Let's imagine on Tuesday, Donald Trump is elected president. To wake you guys up. And let's imagine that Donald Trump makes a law. And in this law he says that, I know that the hypotenuse of a triangle can be longer than the two sides. And not only that, but the president wants everybody else to believe in this truth. And therefore he says anyone who does not declare their belief that a hypotenuse can be longer than the triangle's two sides will be executed. Right, they've committed treason and they'll be executed. Now, let's say I know with absolute certainty that the president is wrong, that a hypotenuse, even though hypotenuses of this sort feature prominently in numerous golf courses and buildings that have a lot of gold, but I'm sure that it's wrong, that there is no such thing as a hypotenuse longer than the sides. So the Inquisition gets up to me and they say, well, do you believe that a hypotenuse could be longer than the sides? Now, I don't think I would necessarily give up my life for that belief, as even though I know it's false. And the reason is because that's rather pointless. It's not something, as even if I know the truth, it's not something that I would think is worthwhile giving up my life for it. So the Kuzari writes a similar thing with respect to the difference between, again, the believer in the God of Aristotle versus the God of Avram. This is source number 3, bottom of page 1. I think we'll just read them in English, since anyway the Hebrew is in translation. This English is not particularly good either, but just to save time. A relationship with God invites its votaries to give their life for his sake and to prefer death to his absence. Speculation, however, makes veneration only a necessity as long as it entails no harm, but bears no pain for its sake. I would therefore excuse Aristotle for thinking lightly about the observance of the law, since he doubts whether God has any cognizance of it. The truth is that he's making over here 2 points. Number one is that a person who believes in God purely based off of logic would not sacrifice his life for 2 different reasons. First of all, like we said, if a person believes in God only because of the logical argument, so then he will likely lack the will to be willing to give up his life for that belief. because it's just something that could be proven. It's a philosophical axiom. But it's not something that you relate to. It's not something that you love. It's not something that would possibly motivate a person to be willing to give up their life. And moreover, even if a person would find the wherewithal to give up their life for their belief, from a philosophical perspective, it doesn't make any sense. It's irrational. It's the height of irrationality, because why would someone be willing to sacrifice their life for a belief in which the being behind the belief, namely God, couldn't care less, doesn't even necessarily observe what we're doing? Interestingly enough, these two points really answer a number of interesting things. The Akedas Yitzchak, Reb Yitzchak Arama, who was a Spanish scholar who lived several centuries later, points out, and this is in source number 4, that is exactly why Avraham Avinu is tested. We find that we have many great people in the Jewish tradition, the Avos, Moshe, Yehoshua. Why is it that Avraham, among all the pantheon of our great heroes, is the one who's tested and tested so frequently with Esar and Nisyonos and the like? And the answer is, take a look where it's bolded, that the notion of a test, and especially the ultimate sacrifice, V'hu shotziyuhu balagamri mimadregos philosoph tiv'i lema'alas torani eloki ki biderech ha-philosophim ein sichlus gedola mizu. These Nisyonos were what elevated Avraham from a philosopher who might believe in the existence of God to ma'alas, the level of torani eloki, the Torah's perspective, one in which a person has a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because the idea, for example, of sacrificing your own son, or even doing a bris milah, makes no sense from the perspective of a philosopher. Whereas for someone who has a love and a fear of God, so then this makes sense. As an interesting historical note, and this relates to the second point that we said, that was the second point, this relates to the first point, the Chassid Yaivitz, Rabbi Yosef Yaivitz, who lived from 1440 to 1508, another great Spanish rabbi, he was among those expelled from Spain in 1492, and he notes in source number 5, the Or HaChaim, it's not the Or HaChaim on the Torah, that among those who were put to the ultimate test during this period of time, it was those whose faith was rooted in philosophical proof, which he compares to a tree that has many branches but shallow roots, that were toppled. And those who had the faith of the ignorant, who he compares to a tree with deep roots, even if there are few branches, those were the ones who, in the time of a great storm, remained steadfast in their belief. We, of course, are very familiar with the great Gerushei Sfarad, who went into exile not knowing their future, leaving Spain rather than convert. Of course, there are many who stayed. We don't judge them. He was, the Chassid Yaivitz was among those who was expelled, and his observation was that among those who left, everybody was a believer, but those whose belief was rooted in philosophy, they generally did not go into exile. They generally stayed, as opposed to those who had this deeper faith rooted in a very deep relationship. The Kuzari then goes ahead and understands that this idea, this innovation of Avraham Avinu, the intimate relationship with God, is reflected in the way in which Avraham Avinu refers to God, and specifically the Shem Havaya, the Tetragrammaton, Yud Kei Vav Kei, which is an actual name, as opposed to simply referring to God as Elohim, or even God, the God of Aristotle. Meaning to say, we in the Torah refer to God by his name. That's very different than God, or Elohim, or the like. We often use the word Hashem to refer to the name. But again, the name is a name. It's a proper noun. It's like Reuven, Shimon, Levi, we refer to God by his name. And that's very different than referring to God as Elohim, as God. Take a look here, source number 6. Amar HaKuzari, the Khazar king said, now I understand the difference between Elohim and the Shem Havaya, the Tetragrammaton. And I see how far the God of Avraham is different from that of the God of Aristotle. Man yearns for the Shem Havaya as a matter of love, taste, and conviction, while knowledge of Elohim is the result of philosophical speculation. And later in the next quote, the Chaver said, a more exact and loftier name is to be found in the form known as the Shem Havaya. This is a proper noun, which could be indicated by attributes, which can only be indicated by attributes, but has no location. Really, what he means to say is, it's a proper noun by which we refer to God. Let's look at the Hebrew; it's a little better. Hu Shem Prati Bo Romzim LeElokah B'Toar HaMakom Keder SheRomzim LeKol Mituar Bilti Yadua VeLo B'Tarim Nosafim Al Atzmuto VeLo B'Hachlala Kevishem HaKlali Elokim Ki Im B'Shem HaMiyuchad Lo His specific name Shekein Hu Nikra Hashem Al Derech HaYichud He's called Hashem. In other words, somebody says, what God? Hashem. Rav Soloveitchik developed this idea very powerfully in The Lonely Man of Faith when explaining the two different creation narratives. As you all noticed from last week's Parsha, the Torah describes creation of the world twice. The first is in Perek Aleph, and the first couple of psukim of Perek Bet. And then, in Perek Bet going on to Perek Gimel, we have the second version of creation. And this is a question that that already the Midrashim and the early Rishonim on the Chumash deal with. Wasn't just invented by biblical critics. But the Rav has a very, very powerful explanation of the Lonely Man of Faith, in which he refers to Adam 1 and Adam 2. The two Adams, the two humans, the prototypes for the two types of relationship with God that were created. And essentially what the Rav notes, and again, we're only going to mention it very briefly, the first chapter of Bereishis describes creation of a man in which first of all, actually, before we get to man, let's look at the name of God. Bereishis bara Elokim. God is not referred to by the Shem Havaya, by his name, but rather Elokim, God. Whereas in the second creation narrative, we're introduced to the Shem Havaya. And that's because Adam 1, the initial creation, again, they're the same person, but the archetype, is someone who relates to the cosmic God. While Adam 2, on the other hand, take a look here at the quote, bottom of page 2, studies the universe with the naivete, awe, and admiration of a child who seeks the unusual and wonderful in every ordinary thing and event. He looks for the image of God not in the mathematical formulas or the natural relational law, as in Adam 1, but in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze, and the stillness of the starlight evening. Adam 1 uses his practical intellect, his scientific ability to comprehend the forces of nature and then to bend them at his will, as the Pasuk instructs him to be kovesh the aretz, to control, dominate nature. Adam 2, on the other hand, does not have such a grandiose self-image. He is humble. He realizes that he's been created from the dust of the earth, which is the emphasis in the second narrative, not in the first. And he allows himself to be overpowered and defeated by God. Again, from the Rav, while Adam 1 maintains some distance from God, relating merely to the divine endowment of creativity, Adam 2... I didn't include this quote, I'm sorry. has a genuine living experience of God and is preoccupied with him, as evidenced by the metaphor of God breathing life into his nostrils. Again, the creation of Adam 2 is very different than 1. First of all, he comes from the dust, and he's created by God breathing life into him. It's a personal, intimate encounter. Elohim, who is described in the first chapter, denotes God as the source of cosmic dynamics, while the Tetragrammaton indicates personal, intimate communion between God and man. Adam 1 is satisfied by impersonal encounter with the former, while Adam 2 craves the latter, the covenantal experience. And this point is really a development of what the Kuzari writes about the difference between the God of Aristotle, someone who simply believes in God because God's existence can be proven, versus someone who has that intimate relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. Adam 1 uses his intellect to relate to God. Adam 2 uses his heart to relate to God. The Kuzari, after describing the differences between these two ways of recognizing and serving God, notes the shortfalls of the philosophical approach. It's not simply that the philosophical approach fails to yield a relationship with God, but it fails to prove the existence of God with whom a relationship is even possible. Meaning to say that philosophy could prove the existence of a deity, but it does not demonstrate that he hears us, that he interacts with us, that he loves us, and that it makes sense for us to love him. Take a look at the next source in the Kuzari, top of page 3. The Khazar king said, "How could I individualize a being if I'm not able to point to it and can only prove its existence by its actions?" And the Chaver responds, "It can be designated by prophetic or visionary means. Demonstration can lead astray. Demonstration was the mother of heresy and destructive ideas. There is a difference between, there's a difference in the ways of demonstration, of which some are more extended than others. Those who go to the utmost length are the philosophers, and the ways of their arguments led them to teach of a supreme being which neither benefits nor injures, and knows nothing of our prayers, offerings, obedience, or disobedience, and that the world is as eternal as he himself." Meaning to say they believe in the eternity of matter. They reject creation, as Aristotle and Plato both did. "None of them applies a distinct proper name to God, except he who hears his address, command, or prohibition, approval for obedience and reproof for disobedience. He bestows on him some name as a designation for him who spoke to him, and he is convinced that he is the creator of the world from nothing. The first man would never have known him if he had not addressed, rewarded, and punished him, and had not created Chava from one of his ribs. This gave him the conviction that this was the creator of the world, whom he designated by words and attributes, and called out in the name of Hashem." What he's pointing out here is that really the basis of this relationship with God, the advantage of Avraham's relationship with God over the philosophers, is first and foremost rooted in prophecy. Adam HaRishon had this prophecy, and as we saw in the case of Avraham from the Medrash we saw at the beginning, Avraham too, after initially discovering God philosophically, experienced prophecy. That's where our parsha picks up on. It's actually interesting, but as I was saying that, I was just thinking, We noted at first it's fascinating that Avram's early history is omitted. And there are a number of reasons for this. The Ramban discusses it, the Maharal does as well. But perhaps part of it is to emphasize the, according to the Kuzari, the aspect of Avraham's chiddush, which we must know. Yes, it might be true that Avram initially discovers God independently, using a type of philosophical argument. But after that knowledge of his existence was cemented, God speaks to Avram. That's the Lech Lecha in our parsha. That was the basis of the relationship that Avram Avinu had with God and that the Jewish people would subsequently have with God. And as we'll see in a moment, what the Kuzari points out is that once you have that relationship, once you know of God's existence, in you have this intimate communion with him, so there is little room for philosophical proof any longer. Take a look. We'll skip a little bit because we're nearly out of time. Source number 10. Perhaps this was Avraham's point of view when divine power and unity dawned upon him prior to the revelation accorded to him. Meaning to say, Avram, like we saw in the Medrash, initially came to an appreciation of God's awareness through the cosmological argument. As soon as this took place, in other words, after he had the relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam, experienced prophecy, he gave up all his speculation and only strove to gain favor of God, having ascertained what this was and how and where it could be obtained. The sages explained the words, and he brought him forth abroad, thus, give up your horoscopy. This means forsake astrology as well as any other doubtful study of nature. The Rav, who again develops this idea in The Lonely Man of Faith, uses a very powerful formulation of Kierkegaard in describing the value of philosophical proof for the person who has this close, personal interaction and relationship with God. Take a look at source number 11. Does the loving bride, in the embrace of her beloved, ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? So asks Soren Kierkegaard sarcastically when told that Anselm of Canterbury, the father of the very abstract and complex ontological proof, spent many days in prayer and supplication that he be presented with rational evidence for the existence of God. It's almost laughable. You're in your lover's embrace and you wonder whether they exist. Someone who has that relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and this is something that we can continue to experience, even if we don't yet have prophecy, has no need for the proof. The proof might be valuable, and this is where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi differs from the Rambam. The proof might be valuable in terms of initially coming to an appreciation and awareness that he exists. But if you have that relationship, you're in that embrace, then what do you benefit from proof that he exists? You know he exists because he's a part of your life. The Rav, in a different context, source number 12, made this point. The problem of evidence in religion will never be solved. The believer does not miss philosophic legitimization. The skeptic will never be satisfied with any cognitive demonstration. In some cases, homoreligiosus is so overwhelmed by the import of his experience that he very distinctly perceives the reality of his object. He is fully conscious of the existence of the transcendental order, meaning to say that there isn't so much value in the types of proofs and arguments in favor for God that are frequently offered. The skeptic will rarely be convinced, and the person who already believes doesn't really need it anyway. And this reflects the transition that took place with Abraham, as noted before. There are two more points that I want to present very quickly because we're out of time. First of all, to fully appreciate the Kuzari's opinion here, we have to have a better understanding of Reb Yehuda Halevi's approach to philosophy in general. Reb Yehuda Halevi is sometimes classified as an anti-rationalist, but if you read his work carefully, he does not categorically reject philosophy. He contends that given their tools, the philosophers actually fared quite well. Take a look, source number 13. There's an excuse for the philosophers. Being Greek, science and religion did not come to them as inheritances. They belong to the descendants of Yefes, who inhabited the north. Basically, the Kuzari, in the next source, he spells it out a little more, notes that given the lack of divine tradition and exposure to revelation, the Greeks, in searching for wisdom and truth, had to rely exclusively upon speculation. And those among them who are humble and intellectually honest acknowledge their limitations. And giving these limitations, they went quite far. And he respects them for that. The Jewish people, on the other hand, have something that the greatest philosophers lacked, which is that we experienced revelation as a nation, and we transmitted that revelation from generation to generation. And because we have that correct conception of God, which allows for the relationship, so we have very little need for the type of speculation that someone who lacks that would have to undertake. So it's not a rejection of philosophy as much as an awareness of its limitations. There's much more to say on that. Finally, I'd like to talk a moment about the Kuzari and applying the Kuzari in the modern world. When you read the Kuzari, he deals extensively with the role of prophecy and how prophecy is in fact the basis of our relationship with God. Of course, we live in a post-prophetic world. We hope it will be restored. Prophecy will be restored one day soon, but for the time being, we lack that prophecy. However, it's clear when you read the Kuzari, and this is something that hopefully in our own lives we can appreciate, the Kuzari argues in favor of the experiential relationship with the Ribono Shalom, not just the intellectual relationship. And that's something that certainly we can continue to have to this day. Whether it's through Talmud Torah, in which we can connect to God on a cerebral plane, but also an emotional plane, whether it's through tefillah, and for different people it's different. Some people connect to God through singing, and others in more through Talmud Torah and the like. But it's something that the notion of having a relationship with the Ribono Shalom, that we don't just serve the God of Aristotle, but we serve through observing Torah and mitzvos, the God of Avraham Avinu, is one that is continues to be powerful. And this brings us to the final point, which we're not going to have a chance to discuss because I have to run to Shir, but which is what should be the basis of our faith nowadays. And I believe that faith is something that's complex and differs from person to person. We alluded to the differing approaches of two great people today, Rambam and Reb Yehuda Halevi. We didn't have a chance to fully develop either. And likewise, for everyone, we all can and should relate to God differently. For some of us, perhaps even if we already believe, searching for further evidence to strengthen that belief is something that's very powerful. The Rambam certainly was someone who had a passionate relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. Anyone who reads his works is overwhelmed by his emotional attachment, even if it was an intellectual emotional attachment to Ribono Shel Olam. For others, the experiential aspects prove to be more prominent. But each and every one of us should think about our belief. And whether we take the approach of Rambam or Kuzari or both, they both discuss the importance of thinking about Emunah. It's not something that's easy, especially if you live in a world, as we do, in which we so frequently encounter an environment that's at odds with our belief. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us to think about these terms, think about why we believe, and think about how we could strengthen that belief. And hopefully, in so doing, we will reach a place where all of us will be Mamin Be'emunah Shleimah. Thank you very much.